From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Over 100 women's health clinics around the country are targeted with anthrax threats this week alone. We'll look at the domestic terrorism that's plagued abortion providers for years. Secretary of State General Colin Powell is in India today, trying to shore up support for nuclear rivals Pakistan and India for the U.S. military campaign as they battle each other. And protesters hit the streets in Canada and Italy, shutting down center city Toronto and demanding peace in the hills of central Italy. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, just blocks from the first Ground Zero, Afghanistan being the second. More than 20 people in Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle's office have tested positive for exposure to anthrax. The tests were conducted after a letter sent to Daschle's office was found to contain a highly refined form of anthrax, suggesting it was produced by experts. The particles are so tiny, they can float a considerable distance through the air on the smallest of air currents without detection. Producing germs that can spread as a mist has been the main technical challenge facing bioweapons programs throughout the 20th century. Police at the Capitol have shut down a full 8-story wing of the building where the letter was found, including the suites of 12 senators with the same ventilation system. The FBI is investigating strong similarities in handwriting and style, including identical anti-U.S. language between the letter sent to Daschle in Washington and a letter with anthrax sent to NBC News anchor Tom Brokaw in New York. Both were sent on the same day. Both were sent from Trenton, New Jersey. The Taliban has for the first time offered to hand over Osama bin Laden for trial in a third country without asking to see evidence first. This according to senior sources in Pakistan, who told this to the British newspaper Guardian. The Taliban foreign minister made the offer in a secret meeting with officials from the CIA and Pakistan's intelligence directorate in Islamabad on Monday. But U.S. officials appear to have dismissed the proposal and are instead hoping to engineer a split within the Taliban leadership. U.S. pilots have for the first time been told to choose their own targets and fire at will within specific zones around Taliban strongholds in Afghanistan. And tens of thousands of dollars have been sent by children in the United States to the White House because President Bush asked them to give money to the children of Afghanistan. That money, he says, will go to the Red Cross. Interesting, as a U.S. fighter has dropped 1,000-pound bombs on Red Cross warehouses in Kabul. Maybe some of that money will go to repair them. The Pentagon said it thought the warehouse was being used by the Taliban. The Red Cross last night condemned the bombing, which destroyed more than a third of the food stored at its site and injured an Afghan security guard. Red Cross officials said the group's symbol was painted on the roofs of the warehouses. And the Bush administration, seeking to promote exchanges of intelligence with China, is considering a waiver on sanctions that bar the sale of military-related equipment to Chinese security forces. The U.S. move on the sanctions, which were imposed after the 1989 crackdown on Tiananmen Square demonstrators, would clear the way for the sale of spare parts for Black Hawk helicopters the United States sold to China during the 1980s. President Bush departs today for Shanghai for a meeting of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group, known as APEC. The Guardian is reporting that the Pentagon has spent millions of dollars to prevent Western media from seeing highly accurate civilian satellite pictures of the effects of bombing in Afghanistan. The images are taken from Iconos, an advanced civilian satellite launched in 1999, and have such high resolution that it would be possible to see bodies lying on the ground after last week's bombing attacks. The decision to shut down access to satellite images was taken last Thursday after reports of heavy civilian casualties from the overnight bombing of training camps northwest of Jalalabad. Obtaining government records might become more difficult under a Bush administration policy change made a month after the September 11th attacks. Attorney General John Ashcroft directed agency leaders to be cautious in releasing records to journalists and others. He said agencies must carefully consider issues such as threats to national security and the effectiveness of law enforcement. The Washington Post reported yesterday that the U.S. government sent high-powered sniper rifles to a group of fighters in Afghanistan that included Osama bin Laden more than a decade ago. This according to court testimony in the gun's maker. The rifles were made by Barrett Firearms Manufacturing, Inc. of Tennessee and paid for by the U.S. government. During the late 1980s, the United States supplied arms worth $500 million a year to anti-Soviet fighters, including Afghanistan's current Taliban rulers, bin Laden, and others. The supplies included a range of weapons from small arms to shoulder-fired Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. And finally, the Israeli tourism minister, Rehavam Zeevi, was shot to death in a Jerusalem hotel today. The Syria-based Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine immediately claimed responsibility and said the shooting was in retaliation for the assassination of the PFLP leader who died in a recent Israeli rocket attack. Rehavam Zeevi caused a furor in July when he referred to Palestinians working and living illegally in Israel as lice and a cancer. Zeevi was also one of seven ultranationalists who pulled out of Sharon's coalition government Monday in protest at the easing of tough security restrictions on the movements of Palestinians. Their resignation was to take effect today.
I woke up moaning in a crowded sick place, surrounded by evil, protected by grace. There were these hands, hundreds reaching for me. They knew exactly who and what I should be. Each way I turn,
each way I turn,
stronger than the last.
Each way I turn,
which would I choose, and how could I pass? Then I would whisper.
I be your water, sweet honey in the rock, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The latest news, as we read at the top of the program, more than 20 people in Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle's office have tested positive for exposure to anthrax after a letter was sent to the office found to contain a highly refined form of anthrax. As the nation is hit by a scare over the potentially deadly anthrax bacteria, employees at women's health clinics around the country are saying this sounds very familiar to us. Reproductive health facilities have been threatened with anthrax, butyric acid attacks. They've been shot at and bombed over a number of years. But the threat has rapidly escalated this week. Over 100 abortion clinics around the country received envelopes containing threatening letters and unidentified powdery substances since Monday. Over 90 Planned Parenthood offices and health centers in at least 13 states have received the envelopes postmarked from five different states. There are no reported injuries at the clinics as of yet, and law enforcement officials say two of the envelopes have been tested by local health agencies and have come back negative. The envelopes mailed to affiliates on the East Coast and Midwest had pre-printed return addresses from the U.S. Marshal's Office and the Secret Service, and some said time-sensitive, urgent security notice, open immediately. According to Planned Parenthood, some of the letters included messages from the Army of God, a militant and elusive anti-abortion group that's advocated violence against medical personnel who perform abortions, as well as staffs of women's health clinics around the country. We're joined right now by two people. Carol Mason is with us. She's a professor of American Studies at Hobart William Smith College and author of the forthcoming book, Killing for Life, the Apocalyptic Narrative of Anti-Abortion Politics. And Anne Glazer joins us. She is director of security for Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Welcome you both to the War and Peace Report. Anne Glazer, how serious are these current threats against women's health clinics around the country?
Well, we take all of these threats seriously. It's been our experience in the past that they are another form of terrorism. So one of the things that you do to fight terrorism is to take a threat seriously, educate yourself about what the risk is, and prepare to meet it whether it turns out to be a hoax or a real matter, so that we are taking the procedures that we've honed over the last several years when we've had these other attacks and instituting them and treating this as a very serious incident. Can I just add something on the reports we're getting this morning? We have some additional reports out of Florida of, quote, positive tests, unquote. These are field tests. And they are highly suspicious, and there are many, many examples of a false positive. What happens is that they culture some of the powder, look for bacteria, and then if they see bacteria, which sometimes can be anthrax and sometimes it's harmless cousins, they then forward the test to be cultured and to grow the bacteria and examine the bacteria then as to whether or not it is anthrax and where it came from. So I really want to caution people when they hear the word positive to say, okay, is this a field test? Is this a full-blown culture?
Can you tell us where these reports have come from in Florida?
One came from West Palm Beach, and I think the other is another location in Florida. One letter.
These were at women's health clinics there?
They were in letters addressed to women's health clinics.
Mm-hmm.
One was in intercepted in the post office in Stuart, Florida, which is in the West Palm Beach area, and another was at an Indian River site where a letter had not been opened, but some powder had spilled on a desk and an employee. So that was yesterday. So the only thing we have is a field test. We do not have a full cultured test.
I was just talking to someone yesterday who works at Planned Parenthood, and we were just talking about the latest overall anthrax threats and very serious cases here in New York at NBC and other places, and the security measures being taken. And she was saying the kind of crackdown on security right now is something that she was talking about Planned Parenthood, have been living with for years.
Yeah.
People's home numbers changed. They're, you know, carefully changed their route when they go to and from work. Their stuff is put through x-rays. There are wanted signs up for the latest man. Who is it? Eric Wagner? Is that his
name? Clayton Wagner.
Clayton Wagner, who has threatened now not just doctors, because he says that they are well protected at this point, who perform abortions, but all of the staff. She said, what we're seeing in the United States today is what women's health clinics have, women who work there and men who work there, have been dealing with for years. But not a lot of people in the United States understand this. Carol Mason, you have been looking at anti-abortion politics in this country. Can you talk about this issue of domestic terrorism?
Sure. I think one of the things that is important to realize about the treatment specifically of the anthrax scares that reproductive health care clinics staff and personnel have had to go through has been, I think sometimes people have not known what the anthrax has been, because in 1998 and 99 in particular, there were these rashes of anthrax scares. And at one clinic, special hazardous chemical emergency crews stripped and scrubbed down people and, you know, basically, you know, treated them as if they were infected. So there wasn't so much a move to antibiotics at that point. So I'm really struck by the difference between the treatments of these anthrax scares. In 99, there were clinics in Missouri, Washington, and West Virginia that received letters that said you've been exposed to anthrax, and 30 firefighters and clinic staff were quarantined and washed down with bleach. So it's very interesting to me to hear how the how people may. I don't know what the discrepancy is, why the attention being paid to the folks who have received the anthrax today is very different from the treatments that they've got. But now we're learning more about that. Amy, can I answer that?
Yes, oh, Ann Glazer of Planned Parenthood.
The reason for the change is the work that Planned Parenthood and other clinics have done proactively. We have been working since 98 and 99 with the Centers for Disease Control, who've been extremely responsive with us, and also local law enforcement, to design procedures to educate people about what anthrax is, how it's spread, how it's contained, how it's treated, and who you report it to. And we have been not just proactive, but really aggressive in working with local hazmat people, state health departments.
Hazmat being hazardous materials.
Hazardous materials, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. To understand this process so that people no longer get taken out into the middle of the street in front of the clinic and go through these horrendous procedures, which are totally unnecessary. So I really am thankful that people are recognizing that there's been some progress made.
But I think there's something very important here. As you said, well, we've been going through this. We've helped to refine the procedures and dealing with this. Most people who listen, and certainly the news media, is saying that, you know, we have never seen anything like this. Now, the level of anthrax contamination may well be the case, but in terms of the threats before this point in these last few weeks, and yet women's health clinics have been dealing with this for quite a time, and the question is, why haven't they been treated as seriously, that staffs there have lived under this terror for quite a while? And we're talking about bombings, shootings, killings. Can you give the list, I mean, first of all, of what the casualty rate has been for this job in America today?
Well, since 1993, seven people have been murdered. Seven abortion providers have been murdered. There have been 15 attempted murders. Between 1990 and 1998, definitely when we had an increase in anti-abortion violence, there were more than 150 incidents of arson at clinics. There were 39 bombings of clinics and over 100 cases of assault and battery. And people might ask, why? How did we move from a direct action protest group that characterized anti-abortion activism to more deadly violence? And I think that's because there was an ethos of retribution that caught on. And that's not just revenge, but the idea of retribution for these anti-abortion activists, that they had the idea that they were restoring what they saw as God's order. So they have a very apocalyptic mindset, and they regard abortion as a sign of the end times, as a sign that God has lifted his veil of protection from the United States because of the in anti-abortion speak, because of the murder of innocents, i.e., fetuses. So it's very interesting to see that this move from the 1980s to the 90s, happened. And in addition to the anthrax scares that we're seeing now and that we've seen for years, there was also a change in the bombing tactics at clinics. And in the 80s, the clinic bombs were set at night. They were bombs designed to blow up the building, to set fire so that people could not work at all. But in the 90s, the bombs were very much like what we saw on September 11th. They would place two bombs at a scene, one to get the media and the feds there, and the other one to be detonated once law enforcement officials would come. In addition, the bombs of the 90s were designed with shrapnel and nails in them, and the goal was clear, was to maim and kill as many people as possible.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, during this time of terror in the United States, Clayton Wagner has he been named one of the 10 most wanted on the FBI list?
Yes, he's on both the FBI list and the U.S. Marshals fugitive list.
And what about the man who was involved with the bombing of clinics, also possibly responsible for the Atlanta Olympics attack, and as well as an attack on a gay nightclub?
Right, that's Eric Rudolph. He has been part of the top 10 FBI list, but of course the new list of 22 most wanted folks, he doesn't appear on that list.
Mm-hmm. Finally, the issue of who the Army of God is, who the people are who are sending out these envelopes, not only to the women's health clinics, mm-hmm. to Tom Daschle, et cetera, they certainly may not be the same. They may not be connected to those who did this September 11th attacks. What are your thoughts on this?
I think that people realize that the Army of God is not a membership group. It's not a particular little group, but it is a name that that anti-abortion terrorists have used to claim responsibility for bombings and assassinations, and it really sort of indicates a similar sort of cell organization or leaderless resistance organization, somewhat like what we suspect of bin Laden's people. So when you hear Army of God, you shouldn't visualize a group of people, but you should visualize a terrorist network.
And many of these people also have been quite outspoken about their belief that it's okay to kill or maim abortion providers,
absolutely,
even clients and bystanders, and yet have been totally unwilling to take responsibility for their own actions and their own rhetoric. And it's kind of, I think, one of the most appalling things about it is to see that many of them in their pronouncements, either publicly or on the websites, seem to think of this as some kind of elaborate game that they're involved in without having to take responsibility and also without having to be held responsible by the rest of us and the community as a whole. So it's quite frightening.
Yeah.
Since the media is always engaged in speculation, and it's interesting that they haven't really separated what happened September 11th from all of these threats right now. But if you're going to look at, and this is often how they engage in it, what has happened before? What is the pattern? Who is likely to have done this that has the same kind of MO? What about the issue of white militias in this country?
Well, I don't think the only difference that I see between domestic terrorism and international terrorism is, which side of the water are they on? I think it's the manifestation of the same kind of activities, the same kind of distorted beliefs, and the same beliefs that somehow religion or their political beliefs holds them above being held responsible. So certainly we would look at any group that I would say qualifies as a domestic terrorism group at the same time that we would look at any other group across the country. Mm-hmm. I remember the bombing in Oklahoma City, literally watching that on TV and hearing people talk about international terrorism, and I'm sort of counting on my fingers going, okay, this is the anniversary date of Waco. This is the anniversary date. There were two other anniversary dates that it was on. Mm-hmm. This is the middle of the country. I would not rule out a domestic terrorism activity here.
Professor Mason, what about that? And what about your investigation of the Army of God and its connection to militias?
Well, I think that it's important to have a history of how anti-abortion violence and the paramilitary right engage one another. You're not going to necessarily find particularly members of the same groups, but I think there is definitely an action and an interaction in ideologies. For example, the aforementioned Eric Rudolph was somebody who was engaged in Christian identity beliefs, and those beliefs are certainly have found fertile ground in the militia movements and in the white supremacist organizing. I think it's also important to realize how anti-abortion folks are responding to the September 11th attacks. And not only Jerry Falwell is, he's not the only one who's seen this as retribution for abortion activity in the United States. Some of the people who have been connected with Army of God, I looked at some of their websites, and I do get a sense that, if I can read a little quote here from one of the websites, they say, in consideration of the semi-horrific, the abortion Holocaust is more fully horrific, they say in parentheses, in consideration of the semi-horrific events that took place on September 11th, 2001 at the World Trade Center, and at the Pentagon, it is plausible to believe that an abortion Holocaust memorial should be built on the major site that is seen as God's warning to mankind that if the real Holocaust does not cease, then there would be far greater disasters and destruction to follow. And to me, this sort of emulates the apocalyptic vision. And it's important to realize that these folks who have been associated with Army of God mentality are connecting what happened on September 11th to abortion provision in the United States.
Has President Bush addressed the issue specifically, well-known anti-abortion activist President Bush, of more than 100 women's health clinics getting these letters just in the last week?
No, we have not heard anything, and we have also not heard anything from Attorney General Ashcroft. He's had a very broad-based statement about anthrax threats, which I think is, that kind of statement should be made, but also I think the recognition that there have been more than 90 letters sent throughout the East Coast and Midwest specifically to a targeted group, and those letters seem to be part of a coordinated plan. I think not addressing that is not only irresponsible, but it's going to make it likely that it's an attractive technique for some other copycat terrorist to use.
It's also important to note that the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, over the years has said getting an amendment to the Constitution passed that would ban abortion would consider his most important act.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Anne Glazer, Director of Security for Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and Carol Mason, Professor of American Studies at Hobart Williams Smith College, author of the forthcoming book, Killing for Life, The Apocalyptic Narrative of Anti-Abortion Politics. When we come back, we'll go to India, where General Colin Powell is. We will also talk about the protests that have been taking place around the world. Stay with us.
Starvation is a creation of the devil, a rebel. I'm bringing food to the people like a widow, bringing flowers to a grave in the middle of the city. Isolation is a riddle, to be surrounded by a million other people, but feel alone like a tree in the desert, dried up like the skin of a lizard, but full of color like the spots of a leopard. Drum and bass pull me in like a shepherd, scratch my itch like a needle on a record, full of life like a man going to Mecca, sky high like an eagle up soaring. I speak low but I'm like a lion roaring, baritone like a Robeson recording. I'm giving thanks for being human every morning, morning, morning. Because the streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend, every box got a right to be booming. Because the streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend, every flower got a right to be booming. Be resistant the negativity, we keep it at a distance. Call for backup and I give you some assistance, like a lifesaver deep in the ocean. Stay afloat here upon the funky motion, rock and roll upon the waves of the season. Hold your breath and your underwater breathing, to be rhyming without a real reason is to claim but not to practice a religion.
Stay human, Michael Franti and Spearhead here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Resistance Radio. Secretary of State General Colin Powell is in India today. As the U.S. attacks in Afghanistan intensify, Powell's trying to shore up support from Pakistan and India as they fight with each other. At a news conference in New Delhi, the Indian Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary stood with Powell. As he said, the U.S. and India are united in their opposition to terrorism and condemn terrorist attacks by Islamic militants in Indian-held Kashmir. After 2 days of fighting in Kashmir, Powell's urging India and Pakistan to start talking again about settling the decades-old problem of Kashmir. We're joined on the phone right now by Sputnik Kalambi, free speech radio news reporter in New Delhi. Can you talk about the significance of today's news conference and General Powell having come to India from Pakistan?
Yes. General Powell has continued his delicate balancing act after coming to New Delhi, after visiting Islamabad. There were no demonstrations to greet him here, but his Indian hosts were clearly unimpressed by the kind of statements he was making. Certainly, he and the Foreign Minister Jaspan Singh said India and the United States should stood shoulder to shoulder in this global fight against terrorism. But as one analyst put it, it's more significant what happened before Powell arrived than when he actually did, because the escalation of fighting that we have seen in the past 2 days across the line of control between India and Pakistan, it does not seem to be a coincidence. And what has gone unreported here is that this escalation in fighting took place when both the Indian and Pakistani armies are carrying out presumably important military maneuvers in the region. So definitely there is the tension is high between the two countries. And at the press conference, the Foreign Minister Jaspan Singh put it as two great democracies who have to agree to disagree, but they don't have to disagree disagreeably. So I think that gives an indication of how convinced the Indians are about what's happening in the region and what the United States is doing.
One of the things that has been raised by the bombing of Afghanistan is the destabilization of the entire region. You have these two rivals, India and Pakistan, nuclear rivals. The U.S. Placed sanctions on them after they both tested nuclear weapons, and yet is lifting those sanctions to get both of them on the side of the U.S. bombing Afghanistan. So this is extremely significant when you're talking about instability and nuclear powers.
Indeed, indeed. And a lot of people are pointing out that this might trigger yet another arms race in the region, because Colin Powell has also been talking about improved military-to-military contacts between the U.S. and Pakistan, and that presumably also includes the sale of military weapons. And India points out that these weapons are being used by Kashmiri militants, what India calls Pakistan-based terrorists, in Kashmir against India. So if New Delhi reasons, the U.S. is not going to include Indian concerns about terrorism in what it calls the first phase of the fight against global terrorism, then India will go it alone. And there are significant sections to the right of the ruling BJP, which heads this unwieldy 24-party coalition in New Delhi, who are very gung-ho about wanting to go in hot pursuit into Pakistani territory. And it is also significant that the controversial former Defense Minister George Fernandes, who was known for his hawkish positions during the last Indo-Pakistani conflict over Kargil, when he deliberately included China in the whole nuclear equation when he defended India's nuclear test. Well, this man, George Fernandes, who was forced to resign 7 months ago after being implicated in a scandal where over corrupt defense deals, has now been brought back through the back door, to the consternation of people even within the BJP and certainly the opposition. And one of his first statements was precisely to say that India is going to be ruthless in crushing militancy. So I don't know if Colin Powell's appeals for restraint are really going to be heard.
Sputnik, General Powell has just left India, headed to Shanghai, to China, with President Bush at the APEC summit that is going to be taking place there. What is China's role in the conflict between India and Pakistan?
Well, China has played, interestingly, a very low-key role in the past few weeks. In fact, I haven't seen any media reports talking about the Chinese angle or the Chinese position in all this, apart from the fact that China also has its own interests in the sense that it is opposed to the Taliban. It is worried about the Taliban's influence and even maybe Osama bin Laden's influence on its Muslim population in Xinjiang. So it has given a cautious approval. I mean, I don't know if that's the word that one can use, but certainly it hasn't taken any very strong positions. What is more interesting is that Iran and Russia, who both share India's position on Afghanistan, all three countries back the Northern Alliance. While Powell was on his way from Islamabad to New Delhi, India was already hosting senior officials from Iran and Russia to, I suppose, fine-tune their position. And that's another point of disagreement. I mean, Colin Powell seems to be going along with the Pakistani proposal that moderate Taliban elements be included in this future Afghan government. India certainly doesn't want to see any moderate Taliban elements or any Taliban elements in this new structure. So there, too, there are differences, not just over Kashmir, but also over the future government in Afghanistan.
In terms of casualties in Kashmir right now, and yesterday, Sputnik, you gave us a background on the whole Kashmiri conflict, but a car bomb exploded in Srinagar, killing more than 30 people. India says it's firing on Islamic militants trying to cross from Pakistan to commit terrorist acts in Indian-held Kashmir. Pakistan accused Indian forces of killing a woman and injuring 25 other civilians. India refusing to accept outside involvement in efforts to resolve the dispute. Powell not making any offer to mediate. Inside Kashmir, where you recently came from, what is the attitude toward the bombing of Afghanistan?
Very, very angry feeling on the streets. Certainly everybody is appalled at this, you know, at the might of the United States being unleashed against a devastated country that is Afghanistan. There's also a great deal of concern and worry over Pakistan's change of position, having ditched the Taliban that Islamabad helped to form and bring to power in Kabul, and people feeling that, when I say people, I mean, I'm talking about the Kashmiri separatist leaders, because the people of Kashmir, unlike, I suppose, the people of Afghanistan, are not really consulted in all this. They find themselves caught between the guns of the militants and the guns of the Indian army. And but the greater fear is that this will definitely spill over into Kashmir. And Kashmir is anyway seeing killings every day. And sometimes, even when 35 people get killed, they say, well, almost 80,000 people have been killed in the last 12 years. There are 4,000 disappeared people. Every day the newspaper has reports of 8 to 10 people being killed in Kashmir, some of them militants, some of them security forces, the large majority probably civilians. So there is a sense of the one word you keep hearing, everything is in the hands of Allah. So it's certainly a very, very traumatized people. And everybody says, you know, you wake up in the morning, you don't know if you're going to come home at night alive. So they're living with death the whole time.
And finally, how much play has the fact that the U.S. House of Representatives has rewarded Pakistan for joining the U.S. in support of the bombing, giving final approval to a measure authorizing the waiver of sanctions that restrict economic aid to Pakistan for the next 2 years? The vote clears the way for an expected $600 million economic package for Islamabad, which would include $100 million in aid announced by President Bush last month.
Well, as I said, I think it will trigger another arms race in the region. I mean, I think this is what Colin Powell was also trying to reassure the Indians about when he said that India and the U.S. had a special relationship and it's independent of the relationship with Pakistan, and New Delhi should not feel threatened by these military-to-military contacts with Pakistan. But I think the Indians have lent a polite ear, but it is significant that just before Colin Powell came, the newly reinstated Defense Minister George Fernandez said they were concluding an important arms deal with Russia. So I imagine we're going to have more and more reports of arms deals in the region, unfortunately, adding to an already dangerous situation that could escalate. And let's not forget, as you said earlier,
but clearly one of the
nuclear countries.
But clearly one of the explanations for the increase in stock prices here for the U.S. military contractors that are benefiting from all of this. So I want to thank you very much, Sputnik Kalambi, for joining us from New Delhi, India. General Powell leaves India right now for Shanghai. You are listening to the War and Peace Report, this unprecedented broadcast collaboration of public media as we broadcast on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Channel 34 and 56, on Dish Network, the Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, on community radio stations around the country, as well as on the internet at WBIX.org and webactive.com. By the way, we want to know what you're doing in this time of war, how you're organizing. You can call us and let us know. We'll be playing some of those comments throughout these days. You can call 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. Stay with us. We'll be back in a minute. Edwin Starr, Stop the War Now. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This latest news just off the wire, a news conference in the Capitol basement. House Speaker Dennis Hastert said a total of 29 people have tested positive for exposure to anthrax in the Senate, including many aides to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and two Capitol police officers. Hastert announced plans to send lawmakers and staff home at day's end to permit health officials to conduct tests through the Capitol complex, where more than 20,000 people work. Hastert said it's in the ventilation system. It's going through the tunnels. It also is, quote, in the mailroom of the Senate where packages move through. We're going to turn right now to protests around the world, protests against the bombing. More than 200,000 people marched through towns in central Italy on Sunday, calling for peace and an end to U.S. attacks in Afghanistan. The annual march to the birthplace of St. Francis of Assisi started 40 years ago by an Italian pacifist. This year drew additional groups, traditional peace groups, left-wing Catholics, trade unionists, and anti-globalization protesters. For the anti-globalization activists in Italy, who've recently turned their efforts to anti-war organizing, it was the first major protest since police killed a demonstrator in Genoa at the G8 summit. Mario Pianta is with us, professor of economic policy at the University of Urbino and a longtime activist with the Italian Peace Roundtable, a network of over 300 peace and civil society groups. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you. Good morning to everybody.
It's good to have you with us. We haven't heard a lot about this mass protest of hundreds of thousands of people. Can you talk about the joining together of the anti-globalization activists with the anti-war protesters?
Yeah, it was really wonderful Sunday to see along 18 miles a continuous line of people marching with all sorts of banners, all sorts of identities mixed together peacefully and with strong determinations. The important experience of this initiative was the ability to combine together a very large spectrum of hundreds of civil society groups, from peace organizations to environmental groups, and on top of them, the three large trade unions of the countries, who, for instance, were outside the protest at the G8 meeting in Genoa last July. Over the summer, since January, there has been a massive wave of mobilizing among a new generation of people. Young people all over the country are organizing collectives and groups, calling themselves the social forum of whatever city they live in. And their agenda combines the need for justice and democracy at the world scale, which are the typical calls of the criticism to the neoliberal model of globalization, and the request from an alternative model of globalization from below, which is probably more specific than the more general no global label that can be put to these movements. And together with this demand from justice and democracy on a global scale, the issue of peace, which has been historically a very important movement of the Italian, and I would say for the whole of Europe in the past decade, has come back again in a very strong way, because what we see with the dramatic news I just heard from you on the insecurity which is spreading in many places in the U.S., is that there is a growing awareness that the security for each and every one of us cannot be guaranteed by the strength, by military strength, by the weapons, by the military action. Security is something which has to be common. Only a common security system built and centered around the United Nations and taking away the power to do justice by themselves from national governments and from the United States in particular can provide hope for the future and reduce the threat of violence and war at the world scale. This is the background which is widely shared by the movements in Italy, but also in Europe. There was a very important document calling the repudiation of war and elimination of terrorism by addressing the fundamental roots of the injustices all over the world, which was the platform for the big demonstration in Italy.
Mario Pianta, the Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi just met with President Bush in Washington. How have people been organizing there in reaction to your Prime Minister's comments about the clash of civilizations and the inferiority of Islam?
Yeah, our Prime Minister Berlusconi is not a highly sophisticated politician and sometimes make incredible leaps in public relation terms. and which, however, reveal what is the real state of mind, what is the real agenda that our governments have. The concept of the clash of civilization has been underlying our policies towards immigration, our policy with the south of the world, our policies at the World Trade Organizations, and the countries of the north in Europe and North America have to really change route on this, in this regard. I think it is important to combine as much as possible the issues of rejection of war and the construction of peace and the nonviolent and the peaceful solution of conflicts with the broader agenda of, critical of the neoliberal model of globalization, which can reverse the trends, the very dangerous trends toward a clash of civilizations.
Will Italian troops fight in the Gulf region?
It is not clear yet. Basically, what happens is that the Italian military forces are not particularly well-developed and well-armed. Italy has often been a very minor military power. The participation of Italian forces to the Gulf War was highly marginal and has often been the result of the an alliance duty to participate to the alliance upholding the close relationship with the U.S. So what I expect is that the Italian government will do whatever the U.S. government demands to do, even though this has to do more with the implementation of a show of solidarity and alliance with the U.S. government rather than any effective military frame of operation.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Mario Pianta, professor of economic policy at the University of Urbino. Again, over 200,000 people march for peace in central Italy on Sunday. This is the Prime Minister of Italy met with Bush this week in Washington, D.C. We're going to turn right now to Canada, to Toronto, where yesterday over 2,000 people gathered in downtown Toronto and closed the city down. It was a combination of anti-war protesters, again, with anti-globalization activists. We're joined on the phone right now by Judy Rebick, who is a columnist for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's News World and publisher of the web magazine Rabble.ca, an author of a book called Imagine Democracy. Can you talk about the coming together, again, as we were just listening to in Italy, of the anti-globalization and anti-war forces and what this means for Canada?
Well, I don't really think the demonstration yesterday necessarily reflects that. What the demonstration yesterday was an anti-poverty demonstration. There were a few people who were, they also went past the U.S. consulate and had some anti-war slogans, but the main thing yesterday was actually the coming together of the anti-poverty movement and some elements of the anti-globalization movement. I think that's more what happened yesterday. So what we see on a whole number of levels is the anti-globalization movement broadening out, if you want, to other issues, and in this case, the issue of poverty. But in fact, in Toronto a couple of weeks ago, the first demonstration against the war, first big demonstration against the war was about also about 1,500 people was organized at a very last-minute basis, and that really did include bring together an anti-war and an anti-poverty movement. And there's a new demonstration being planned for this weekend, that is bring together a new coalition. And that's happening right across the country. There's been demonstrations every week in Montreal. There's been demonstrations every week in Vancouver, and they're bringing together the old, if you want, the old peace movement and the new globalization movement.
Amber Sands is also on the line with us, an OCAP organizer. That's Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. Your protest taking place in the midst of the bombing of Afghanistan in Canada has sent military support for the U.S.-British bombing. How do you see these two issues coming together at this point?
I think one of the main focuses of the demonstration that happened yesterday in Toronto was to make very clear that poverty issues have not gone away in the wake of the militarization that Canada has been participating in, and to make sure that people can remember that the Tenant Protection Act getting trashed, that housing issues that we have in Toronto, poverty issues we have in Toronto are still in effect, even even during this crisis that's happening, and to make sure that not only the media but the people of Ontario don't forget that, that these are issues we've been fighting for a very long time now, and we'll continue to fight in the coming months for sure.
You also have this interesting situation where at the same time that the economic protests, your protests for the poor and protection of the poor are taking place in Canada and the bombs are dropping in Afghanistan, Canada introducing increasingly repressive legislation around civil rights. We're going to turn now to Alan Borovoy, who is general counsel of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, talking about the new laws that have just been introduced to be weighed and passed on by the Canadian Parliament. This is Alan Borovoy.
The crux of it is that a wave of new powers are created, and it turns on a definition of terrorist activity that is dangerously overbroad. It would make it an offense to raise money to help organizations. Let's say if they're Canadian citizens want to raise money for groups overseas that might be exerting various coercive pressures on their governments, and not necessarily what we would call terrorist pressures, not necessarily situations where they would be deliberately targeting innocent civilians for serious violence. This is so broad that it might have been an offense a few years ago to raise money for Nelson Mandela's organization in South Africa. It also is broad enough to make terrorists out of people engaging in civil disobedience that might cause some disruption to essential services. And while we're not suggesting for a moment that it is not legitimate for law enforcement authorities to stop people engaged in civil disobedience, we don't think all of that civil disobedience, whether it's caused by organizations like Greenpeace or some native groups or something like that, there's no excuse to treat them all as though they were the kind of terrorists that inflicted that awful damage in New York City.
Amber Sands, are you concerned about this legislation coming down at this time that you're doing organizing? And we only have 20 seconds.
Yes, definitely. Anti-poverty activists are very concerned about it in Toronto after the aftermath of the demonstrations yesterday and the over 40 arrests that happened and threats from the mayor of Toronto to sue organizations that participated in it. He also mentioned using the new anti-terrorism laws against activist organizations, and there's definitely concerns about what kind of repercussions are going to be we're going to be faced with as activists in the city.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us. We're certainly going to continue this conversation in the coming days. Amber Sands of the organization OCAP, Judy Rebick, columnist for Canadian Broadcasting, and Alan Borovoy, general counsel for Canadian Civil Liberties Association. That does it for the program. We'd like to hear from you. We're still looking for Mac computers. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland's at WBIX.org, where you can hear Democracy Now! Along with WebActive.com. Amy Pomerlo, thanks at KPFA, and Aaron Glantz of Free Speech Radio News. Thanks to KPFA and affiliate station KFCF, and to all the Pacifica affiliates. We are Pacifica. We're broadcasting from in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
With information that would never be reported, disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported, disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Ha ha.
Michael, my dear, come say this about time.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back.
to apathetic bullshit. Send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information